May we proceed, please, with case number one, the United States versus Jade Wilson. And Cindy.
Good morning, Your Honor. That please the court. I'm Terry Green. I'm the trial counsel for Jade Wilson in the district court. Dan Goggin, Cindy Wilson's attorney, was a trial counsel for her at the district level. And we're here on the consolidated appeal of these two ladies who were tried together on the charge of conspiracy.
And now you're going to share your time?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I'll have 4 minutes, and Mr. Goggin will have 5 minutes with 1 minute of rebuttal.
Right.
Your Honor, the defendants in this case, mother and daughter, Jade being the daughter, some 22 years of age, the mother, Cindy, in her 40s, tried together on these counts where they're both charged with a conspiracy with persons named and unnamed. Jade was charged with three deliveries or possessions with intent to deliver, and Cindy with one in possession with intent to deliver. We have basically four issues which we bring, one being the whether the charging instrument did in fact stand as an indictment, the other issue of failure to give the buyer-seller instruction, whether the evidence was sufficient to support a conspiracy conviction, and as it relates to Cindy, whether or not the special verdict returned by the jury finding her guilty of between 5 and 50 grams worked as an effective acquittal on the charge of conspiracy over 50 grams. I'd like to address myself to two issues, that being the issues having to do with the charging instrument and the third issue, which we raised in our brief, being the sufficiency of the evidence. Now, the charging instrument, which was in Appendix A, Exhibit A of our appendix, does in fact allege, and we will acknowledge that the government has argued in their brief, that it does say the words the grand jury charges. There is a line there that says true bill, another where there's a signature of a four-person.
Well, are you confused by that?
Your Honor, the issue...
No,
that we
just answer me that. Are you
am
confused?
I? Yeah. No. No,
Your Honor. Do you think the defendant was?
Your Honor, the... I don't know. Obviously, I have more experience in the law than she did, and... Whether she knew it was a charging instrument.
Did she tell you that she was confused and didn't know what she was charged with?
Well, as oftentimes happens in these types of cases, they sit there and you try to explain to your clients what in fact is going on, and of course they keep saying they don't understand, and et cetera. But I believe that ultimately she would have known, yes, that it was some type of a charging instrument. Yes, sir. Now, obviously, it's raised whether this is a spurious argument as a defendant to get off on a technicality because the words indictment or information or what do not appear. Now, we would argue that this is not a spurious argument, that a defendant is to get off on a technicality. In essence, Your Honor, we are a person who's learned in the law or at least has some experience in the law to make the assumption because of these various elements that we described, the word grand jury and true bill, it was an indictment. The magistrate assumed it was an indictment. Obviously, the United States attorney did. The clerk who filed the case would make that assumption. And the trial court would also be required to make the presumption it was an indictment. My question, or the issue as I see it, is we have an instance where the government is going to take a 22-year-old, take her off the streets for 20 years of her life, and arguably the best years of one's life, her mother, lock her up, separate from her daughter, where they could have no contact with some document. They haven't taken the trouble to proofread or at least put them on actual notice that it is, in fact, an indictment. Now,
I think you've made your point in that.
Yes, sir. The other issue that I'd like to address is the one with the sufficiency of the evidence. And that being that, obviously, we say there was a high standard that has to be met, and that being the evidence in light most favorable government supports the conspiracy, and we would posit that it does not. There were 17 witnesses. Two were police witnesses who testified as to the deliveries, which were never denied by the defendants, whereas all the other witnesses were Rule 35 witnesses and others, and we would argue that they did not support the evidence was insufficient to support the conspiracy count. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor.
You were? Thank you. Thank you for telling me.
The issue I would address to the court first is regarding the absence of the buyer-seller jury instruction that was omitted before giving.
Pretty clear that was waived, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, in our initial brief, I kind of took that position that we didn't raise it before it went back to the jury. But after spending some time preparing the rebuttal brief, what had happened, Your Honor, was I'd submitted it to the trial court per their instruction at the beginning of the trial. The law clerk took it upon herself to determine it did not apply in this case, and she took it out of the instructions to be presented before Judge Foreman. When it came up, when I caught it, that it wasn't being read to the jury, when I first raised it, or when the judge called the sidebar, and I raised the issue, the clerk responded, I took it out because it didn't get read because it wasn't applicable to the case. And I thought, well, the judge ruled on that issue and I did not catch it. I don't remember it. But looking back, what had happened was, at that present moment, I wasn't aware that she had used her discretion to remove it from the pile of instructions to be ruled on. And it was never ruled on. The law clerk took it out on her own discretion. And I think your ruling in the Thomas case presents the issue whether or not this meets the plain error test, and I think it does. I think what we have here, and what counsel touched on, was a situation where there were four controlled buys of the mother and daughter. All of them took place at the residence. All of them were effectuated by one undercover agent. I think the jury, if we're properly instructed, could have come back and said, look, you know, this guy came and effectuated these buys. These weren't people out on the street selling crack. They were selling to a friend. And I think what's most telling on the record, Your Honor, is the fact that after Cindy Wilson made her one transfer to the undercover agent, she said, don't tell anybody I've got this. And I think what's very telling about that statement is it negates the contention that there was a conspiracy. I think she was selling to a friend or someone she knew very closely. She wasn't out to profit. If you're out trying to profit in business, you don't tell people.
What does a friend mean to you?
Someone that she's acquainted with. And
that's a friend?
She would stray from her normal behavior and actually do something of an illegal matter. I think the fact that she used those words, don't tell anybody I've got this, negates the fact that she's out trying to profit in the drug business. I mean, if you run a, say, Marshall Field, when he was alive 100-some years ago, he wouldn't dare tell his customers, don't tell people. He might have told the poor people that, but he didn't tell the upper echelon, don't tell people we have gloves on sale. Marshall Field wouldn't do that.
Not comparing Marshall Field to a drug salesman, right?
Well, I think they go hand in hand. I think
might be a good comparison. I mean, if you read the whole life of
thank you, Your Honor. The next issue is the effective acquittal issue. And I think if you look at Apprendi, if you start with the charging offense that was set out in the statute, which is 841A1, if you get convicted of that without anything else, there's no penalty provision. And I got that, and I couldn't find it. I did a habeas corpus case for an inmate who, you know, they're very diligent about researching issues, and he had a record of an appeal case that was before Justice Scalia at the Supreme Court, and Scalia inquired about this very issue. 841A, without anything else, does not have a penalty provision. And I think if you start with that approach and you look at Apprendi, I think what Apprendi stands for, without more, you can suffer a conviction under 841A1 and not have a sentence. And I think what happened in this case by the jury coming back and determining that she had an amount below the 50 grams, which she was charged with, an amount above that, I think that effectively acquits her on that charge under Apprendi. And I think if you look at my analogies in the illustration about Juan Valdez and then John and Dave's conviction for just the agreement, which is a crime, to agree to distribute crack, but they were raided before they could effectuate their agreement, and they were charged. Well, what
they could be convicted under the conspiracy charge, but they cannot be sentenced without more, without some kind of determination by the jury that there was some drug amount involved. I don't think the charging document alone under 841A1 implies that there's any amount involved in the conspiracy. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the Court. With respect to Issue 1, there is no requirement in Federal Criminal Procedure 7 that the charging document be titled with the words indictment. This document was headed with the words the grand jury charges. It was signed by the grand jury foreperson. It was signed by the government attorney, and it has all the necessary elements under Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 7. With respect to Issue 2, we believe that a buyer-sell relationship instruction was not warranted in this case, since the evidence showed that there was much more going on here than a mere buyer-seller relationship between Jade and Cindy and all of the witnesses that testified at trial. The evidence showed that Jade and Cindy were a mother-daughter team that worked out of their trailer. They had many of the same customers and many of the same suppliers. The witnesses testified that if one wasn't available, the other one was. They could buy from the other one. We had a witness testify that in July 2000, she saw Jade and Cindy, as well as Jade's boyfriend, Garrett Watson, in the trailer bagging up crack cocaine to sell. The conspiracy lasted 3 years, and over that three-year period, a large amount of drugs was distributed. And finally, the customers testified that they bought repeatedly from the defendants, usually in the same manner and at the same place. There wasn't just single transactions between these witnesses. We believe that this evidence shows that this was not just a mere buyer-seller relationship, and therefore the instruction was not warranted.
Were some of these sales made on credit?
Yes. Witness Owen Twiggs testified that he was fronted the crack cocaine from the defendants, and that he would pay for it later after he sold it. With respect to Issue 3, we believe that, as I just set out with Issue 2, the evidence was more than sufficient to support their convictions for conspiracy. As I just said, they had many of the same customers, many of the same suppliers. They worked out of the same trailer. Customers knew that if one wasn't there, they could just buy from the other one. As to the defendant's argument that the witnesses were not credible because they were Rule 35 witnesses, as this court knows, credibility issues are for the trier of fact. Besides, this issue was never raised in the first appellate brief, so we believe it's not properly before the court. With respect to the final argument, we believe that the jury's finding in the special verdict that the amount proven with Cindy Wilson being only between 5 and 50 grams of crack was not an effective acquittal of her charge under count one of conspiracy to distribute more than 50 grams. It was possible for the jury to find that Cindy was only personally responsible for the smaller amount, but that the overall conspiracy involved more than 50 grams. If you look at Jade's special verdict form, they found that Jade was personally responsible for over 50 grams. With respect to the Apprendi argument, there is no Apprendi violation here. Cindy was sentenced to 210 months, which is well below the 40-year statutory maximum that was triggered by the 5 to 50 gram range that the jury found her responsible for. And if there are no questions, then I'm done.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Briefly on the issue of the sufficiency of the evidence, the court inquired about whether or not the transactions, some of them, were on credit. The transactions that were proven at trial were not on credit. Those were just simple buyer-seller, all effectuated by the undercover agent at the residence, and he had to honk the horn for them to come out. It wasn't like they were standing out doing business. There was testimony of Dolan Twiggs that he paid for some of his stuff later, but I think the way that his testimony can be looked at the record with some of the other Rule 35 witnesses. But as to this issue of indictment and whether or not the wording's required, it almost gives me a headache to think that the government's response is it's not required by the rule to be on there. Well, when you're graduated from college or law school or whatever, your diploma says diploma. Your license on your law degree says license or authorized to practice. It's a little foolish in my sense, especially when you have a provision for future sentencing that's dependent on an indictment rather than information as far as enhancement, that we could conclude that the word indictment's not required on an indictment. I think later on down the road that causes a big problem for future sentencing. And for all those reasons and what the other counsels presented, we'd ask that the court reverse the convictions or remand it for a new trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Court will